much to Stephanie and Mark for inviting us to participate in this event. And congratulations on hosting such a dynamic seminar series through the Global Labor Research Center this term. I must say, I teach Tuesday and Thursday from 11:30 to 2:30, so I haven't been able to come to any of those but the ones I've helped organize. But anyway, they've been really exciting, and I'm looking forward to hearing the audio tapes of several. So thanks so much. So before presenting our papers, Mark and Stephanie asked me to provide an introduction to the Closing the Enforcement Gap project, from which today's session emanates. And so this project, the Closing the Enforcement Gap project, is a five-year partnership project that's studying employment standards and their enforcement in Ontario. The project departs from the dual observation that on the one hand, precarious jobs that are characterized by job insecurity, lack of control over the labor process, limited access to the regulatory protections that you'll hear about today, and low incomes are spreading in Canada, particularly among women, among migrants, immigrants, and racialized groups, as well as young people. And on the other hand, employment standards that set minimum conditions in areas such as wages, working time, vacations and leaves, and termination and severance are often the only source of workplace protection for workers in these jobs. And yet, there is growing evidence of routine violations of these standards and limited enforcement practices. So our goal in closing the enforcement gap is to develop an improved understanding of the nature of violations and ES enforcement processes, employment standards enforcement processes, in order to establish, improve, help contribute to improving effective protection for workers in precarious jobs. And the partnership brings together community organizations at the forefront of employment standards enforcement efforts and scholars with expertise in the area. Specifically, the research involves all the community legal clinics in Ontario that assist people with work-related problems, worker centres, a private law firm, the Ontario Public Service Employees Union, the Law Commission of Ontario, the Ministry of Labour, and academics from seven Canadian universities, as well as a number of international collaborators. We're just completing our first year, and we're trying to employ a multi-method, cross-sector research strategy. Our focus is Ontario, not solely because we're here, but because it's Canada's most populous and industrially diverse province and host to the majority of recent immigrants, and also a really central site of recent efforts to so-called, according to the ministry, modernize employment standards enforcement. So the key objectives of the partnership are to map the nature and the scope of employment standards violations, to document enforcement practices in order to identify regulatory challenges, to develop alternative models of enforcement that may be applied not only in Ontario but in other places in Canada and internationally. And so to do so and investigate this, the multidimensional nature of what we're calling the enforcement gap, researchers have divided themselves into five working groups, essentially. One that involves statistics and a survey, and John's going to talk about the research, some of the research that's going on there, and archives and a policy group, and Mark and Eric will talk about some of that work. A group investigating the enforcement practices of the MOL, the Ministry of Labour, that Mark and Eric will also talk about, and a workers' inquiry group, as well as a working group that will build on these groups to talk about alternatives towards the end of the project. So, as I said, so today's seminar will highlight some preliminary findings. We're just at the end of our first year of the working groups on the statistics and the survey, archives and policy, and current practices of the Ministry of Labour. So I'll begin by presenting a co-authored paper prepared to help us locate new and emergent practices of enforcement in Ontario in comparative context. Which I wrote with John Grundy and Mark Thomas. And John will then present a paper prepared by several researchers involved in the developing a telephone survey, which we've just piloted and we will put out in full scale in about a year's time. of Ontarians on their experiences of what we call violation, evasion, and erosion of employment standards. And finally, Eric and Mark will present a paper in progress on the operation, or lack thereof, of practices of deterrence in employment standards enforcement in Ontario. We were today to hear from Mary Galatly, the community co-lead of the project, but unfortunately, Mary has had a death in her family. And so she was to discuss community campaigns against wage theft. And it is my hope that we'll organize something in the not-too-distant future that will involve Mary and others in the project. So moving then to our first paper, which I'll present. It is titled Challenging New Governance, Evaluating New Approaches to Enforcement, Employment Standards Enforcement in Common Law Jurisdictions. And as I said, it's based on a paper that I co-authored with Mark Thomas and John Grundy. So in common law jurisdictions such as Canada, the U.S., the U.K., and Australia, deregulation through legislative reform and declining rates of unionization is fueling the growth of precarious employment. In such contexts, employment standards, as I mentioned, are the only source of workplace protection for a mounting number of workers. Yet there's growing evidence in these contexts that noncompliance with employment standards is becoming a key strategy of labor cost reduction, particularly at the lower end of the labor market. As a result, enforcement agencies traditionally oriented around handling individual complaints are struggling to manage their expanding mandate. This crisis in employment standards regulation is prompting extensive experimentation among governments, including Ontario, with new measures across all stages of the enforcement process. And such experimentation bears evidence, we argue, of the influence of what is often called new governance in regulatory practice, a paradigm assuming that the growing complexity of regulatory problems effectively render obsolete centralized modes of public authority. So focusing on reforms underway in common law jurisdictions today, I'll use my time to raise some serious cautions about new governance-styled employment standards enforcement mechanisms. And I'll argue that such arrangements run the risk of exacerbating rather than mitigating the enforcement crisis that we're in, especially if they're taken as a wholesale replacement of public enforcement by failing adequately to account for power dynamics in the employment relationship. And in making this argument, I'll proceed in three sections. First, I'll outline and begin to assess principles underpinning new governance style enforcement reforms. And second, I'll explore the implications of these three principles by reporting on a select number of experiments, new governance influence experiment, reform experiments in these four jurisdictions that I mentioned. And third, based on our empirical cases, I'll try to conclude by introducing four alternative normative principles that aim simultaneously to recognize the limitations of both outmoded traditional modes of public regulation and new governance. So turning then to first explain a little bit or say a few words about the concept of new governance and how we conceptualize it. Essentially, for us, it refers to a new paradigm for the organization of political authority that emphasizes collaboration of institutions and actors drawn both from and beyond the state in pursuit of social and economic goals, in place of traditional hierarchical and centralized organization of public authority. New governance emphasizes mutual dependence and shared interest among actors. It's often said that under the governance paradigm, the role of the state is to steer rather than row. And so new governance reforms have been highly influential in a range of areas of public regulation, including employment standards. They reflect the growing sentiment among policymakers that public regulation, often deemed command and control, and defined as the imposition of standards by the public regulatory agency, backed by the threat of legal punishment, which Eric and Mark will talk about later, are inflexible and unnecessarily complex, and that they thwart innovation and competition. So proponents of new governance reject the adversarial logic of detecting and punishing wrongdoing, because it fails to distinguish between good and bad actors, and it exacerbates, they argue, antagonisms between regulators and the regulated. In response, they try to redress the deficiencies of state-centric adversarial public regulation through greater self-regulation. So developments in employment standards regulation, where, as Estlin notes, quote, the locus of enforcement is moving inside the workplace and away from direct public monitoring, really reflect this emphasis on self-governance. In this domain, new governance advocates argue that economic and technological transformation, such as complex supply chains and such, coupled with the twin problem of an expanding mandate and declining resources, make effective public regulation unlikely. They thus typically support a third way between supposed bureaucratic inefficiencies of command and control and the market regulation of neoliberalism. Yet in taking as a starting point the goodwill of employers and the related need to minimize adversarial relations, new governance may serve, we argue, to facilitate deepening asymmetries in power that we're observing. So in undertaking our empirical analysis, we identify and pose a series of questions regarding three principles of new governance with key implications for employment standards enforcement. The first, oops, is this the wrong one? They should be all there. The first principle is a plurality of enforcement instruments, mechanisms, which entails the expansion of policy instruments available to regulators. New governance reforms often pursue compliance and firm buy-in through soft law. Thank you. Arrangements such as persuasion and negotiation, codes of conduct, and information sharing. And here we're concerned to discern the likelihood that a particular model will lead to deregulation and how and to what extent arrangements bring enforceable penalties to bear on employers that fail to comply with the law. We therefore ask, what are the concrete costs of noncompliance? At what point does self-regulation give way to public enforcement? And specifically, what situations trigger hard sanctions? The second principle we identify, which is really a centerpiece in new governance, is stakeholder participation. And and we call it participatory enforcement, whereas in ES enforcement under public regulation is conceived as a relation between the public regulators and employers, new governance relations purportedly offer a variety of opportunities to a wider range of actors to be involved in the process. And these actors range from workers themselves to unions, professional and industry associations, community groups, and certified monitors. And many observers here question the capacity of the proposed system of employee representation to exercise worker voice effectively, especially in unionized environments. Non-unionized environments. And regarding third-party engagement initiatives, there's a lot of questions here that are raised by critics of the voice of workers' advocates in these arrangements. So in evaluating how enforcement systems involve different actors, we feel we must ask how such measures compensate for the unequal distribution of power in the workplace. To what extent do committees of workers and their representatives have access to external public enforcement systems? Can these relations that be formalized, sustained, and vigorous? And the final new governance principle with strong implications for ES enforcement concerns accountability. So new governance, and I think, I'm not sure this is the right slide, John, actually. Yeah, oh, there we go. New governance essentially alters the way in which accountability has traditionally been secured between enforcement agencies and legislative bodies. Under public enforcement, bureaucratic coordination ensured a kind of hierarchical chain of command and administration, and administrative law guaranteed due process to individuals filing employment standards enforcement complaints. But new governance advocates argue that the result is increasingly a very highly bureaucratized situation and bureaucratic disentitlement as a result. The logic of new governance alters this coordination. It fragments authority. People are not subject to traditional channels of accountability. Accountability is increasingly, and we know this in the university, I think, just looking at how things are changing, accountability is increasingly redefined as performance. Agencies increasingly measure their activities against performance targets through measurable outcomes. And new governance enforcement systems introduce the need to make regulatory agencies more responsive to regulated entities and the competitive pressures that they face. So in response to this, we ask, what are the implications of these reconfigurations of accountability? And when accountability is defined as performance, what is the effect on workers seeking redress? So now I just want to briefly evaluate our empirical cases against these critiques and talk to you a little bit about experiments in some common law jurisdictions. These experiments build on aspects of the new governance principles I've just discussed, and they cut across three stages of the enforcement process: prevention, complaints, and dispute resolution. And they also, interestingly, operate at different scales: the city, the region, and the nation. Two programs developed. By Australia's Fair Work Ombudsman, or the FWO, exemplify new governance emphasis on collaborative forms of regulation that aim to maximize the impact of resources by enlisting the internal regulatory capacity of firms. The first is called the National Employers Program, established in 2010. It's a free educational service for employers, and an FWO representative representatives work with firms' management officials for up to 3 months to develop their capacity to monitor compliance with employment standards. By June 2013, so just 3 years after its introduction, there were 117 national enterprises with more than 551,000 employees involved in the program. And growing out of this program, the National Franchise Program in Australia uses the surveillance capacity of franchisers to do something quite similar. Under this program, a dedicated Fair Work Advisor collaborates with a franchisor to develop a compliance strategy based on the particular needs and structure of the franchise operation, and this subsequent program has involved more than 48,000 employers. Now, while exemplifying a greater role, the greater role that new governance makes available for employers, these measures are problematic in a number of ways. The central actors are the Fair Work Ombudsman representative, or the FWO representative, and firm management, and there's little room for the expression of workers' voices or that of third parties, for that matter. And these are central limits with regard to the second principle of participation. So it's an inherently limited form of collaboration. The dispersion of regulatory responsibility in the new governance principles is exemplified in another set of programs we examined that are run by the Los Angeles Unified School District and the Los Angeles Board of Public Works, which deputize representatives from local building trades and trade unions to enforce workplace standards on school district and public works projects. Union representatives are authorized to enter the project, conduct inspections, interview workers about violations, help them fill out complaint forms, and they provide workplace data to city inspectors who determine violations and penalties, which can include formal sanctions. These programs also display key elements of new governance through their involvement of third-party representatives, such as union inspectors. But the problem with them is that the representatives are not allowed to advocate for workers in the assessment and enforcement process. So they're allowed to play mainly a fact-finding role. Nevertheless, the programs provide for a strong sense of public accountability through both the integration of volunteers into the work structure and the relationship with the state regulatory agency and the union. In a range of jurisdictions, the complaint process is also a mounting source of frustration, including ours, due to the growing backlogs and a lengthy resolution process. Many of you will have heard that just a couple of years ago, there was a backlog of 14,000 complaints in Ontario. The UK-based Citizens Advice Bureau provide an example of the new governance logic of self-help and shared responsibility for problem-solving. CAB advisors aim to empower workers, similar to the LAUSD example, by providing information, though, in this case, and legal advice assistance, letter writing, and advice on self-representation, which is how it works in the UK, at employment tribunals, and referrals to more qualified experts where appropriate. CAB do not hold a formal role in the broader process of enforcement outside complaints, as they neither participate in investigations nor engage in determining and enforcing sanctions. Overall, they reflect the new governance emphasis on individualized self-representation, while at the same time bolstering a system of public enforcement. So CAB nonetheless, though, operate in a context of broader processes of regulatory degradation, suffering from inadequate resources, unstable funding, and insufficient expertise, demonstrating the limits of these new forms of accountability. Now, moving to the final stage of the enforcement process, dispute resolution entails the processes that workers, their representative, employers, and state officials follow to determine and administer remedies that are owed to workers. Ontario's new self-help model represents a new governance approach to dispute resolution, we argue, in that it emphasizes worker responsibility and involves mediation in the settlement of disputes. Under our province's Open for Business Act, the government made it mandatory, it was introduced in 2010, that workers first seek compliance directly from their employers before they file an ES complaint. Simultaneously, it introduced a requirement whereby workers are to provide details in writing, in English, sufficient in order for the case to proceed. And it also empowers employment standards officers to mediate dispute settlements. Consistent with developments in other jurisdictions like British Columbia and Canada, this self-help model fails to recognize power imbalances between workers and employers. The fact that the self-help model fails to provide, for example, third-party representation deepens workers' voicelessness. Finally, consistent with new governance's emphasis on the use of extra-legal, more flexible enforcement instruments, Australia's enforceable undertakings are, and here I quote the legislation, promises enforceable in court offered by an individual or normally a firm who has allegedly breached the law and accepted by a regulator. Enforceable undertakings provide regulators with flexibility when determining both a breach and an appropriate regulatory response. So with the introduction of Australia's Fair Work Ombudsman, which I mentioned earlier, they have entailed the admission of the contravention that the employer has violated, a description of it, an agreement to remedy the contravention, including a time frame and an acknowledgement that should the wrongdoer fail to comply with the voluntary enforceable undertaking, the Fair Work Ombudsman may apply for a court order. Because of their flexible character, we argue that enforceable undertakings have the potential to support worker voice, especially since workers facing violations also have recourse to external public enforcement in the end, if they fail. That said, and we also find a particularly innovative feature, the fact that the wrongdoer must publicize their own failure to comply. That said, given their recent introduction, it's hard to really evaluate the enforceable undertaking. So the embrace of new governance reforms that aim to decenter state regulation with a greater emphasis on voluntary soft law and multi-party regulatory strategy runs the risk, we argue, of exacerbating the already present regulatory crisis in employment standards enforcement and overlooks the reasons for models of public enforcement that involve forms of hard law regulation. Nonetheless, given the crisis of employment standards enforcement and the persistence of employer noncompliance with legislative standards, The need for reforms to traditional enforcement mechanisms is also apparent to us. So we propose four principles that recognize the limitations of modes of public regulation in the face of and in an era of precarious employment, and new governance models that should underpin a regulatory strategy aimed at preventing further regulatory degradation. The first principle is, or we talk about as basically maintaining a prominent role for hard enforcement mechanisms. Effective employment standards enforcement must include a clear role for hard law sanctions, we argue. This principle informs other aspects of our ongoing research, including the paper that Eric and Mark will present on deterrence. The second principle entails augmenting worker voice across all stages of the enforcement process. Employment standards enforcement must provide the means for effective worker voice in prevention, complaints, and disputes resolution. And the third principle involves making a commitment to the creation of meaningful participatory structures. There must be expanded opportunities for public input into employment standards enforcement in the context of declining rates of unionization and individualized enforcement systems. And finally, the fourth principle is ensuring the accountability of regulatory agents for upholding the substantive objectives of ES legislation. Well-defined structures of accountability are needed to ensure the integrity of enforcement procedures, particularly in their role to maintain objectives of social minima, universality, fairness, and the need to counteract inherently unequal power dynamics of the employment relationship to protect workers against exploitation. So these normative principles aim to point the way towards developing reforms that mitigate regulatory degradation and that are often disguised through resorting to the rhetoric of new governance, while recognizing that certain aspects of traditional modes of public regulation are indeed out of sync with labor market realities. Thanks. Great. Thank you.